Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we are talking about extraterrestrial life, aliens, UFO sightings, all of it. Because there's like a few very specific things we seem to always assume about life on other planets and intelligent life on other planets that I had kind of always assumed without realizing it until a couple years ago. I think it's kind of based on the two basic types of aliens we encounter in pop culture. You've got the aliens you see getting reported by the news and sort of reported by conspiracy theorists and History Channel. And then, you know, the aliens we see in alien movies. Let's talk about those first, because we don't get to those until kind of deep into the conversation. We start off with the crackpot conspiracy theory. Aliens. So there have been thousands of movies about extraterrestrials coming to teach us something or kill us or enslave us. They're really kind of the most convenient movie bad guy because, hey, you can give them dreadlocks if you're scared of people with dreadlocks and you don't have to feel racist. But point is, we should have made up all of the aliens by now, right? Only limits our imagination. But almost all of our ideas for alien life forms that we put in movies have a few kind of huge assumptions that we all sort of just take for granted when we're thinking about aliens now. Like the idea that they'll care about us, for instance, that we'd be important enough for them to fly across the universe to visit. Obviously, that's kind of crucial for the purposes of moving the plot forward, but think about it logically. So the nice aliens come to communicate with us and teach us lessons, but why would they treat us with more respect and more like equals than we treat life forms on Earth that are slightly less intelligent than us? That's one of the questions that's going to get raised. Bad aliens invade us for our resources, which assumes these beings with light speed travel would have the same resource shortages we have on Earth and the small area around Earth we've been able to hang out in without dying, the moon and near orbit, basically. But we know that's not true, right? I mentioned on a past podcast, and I think I bring it up in our conversation, that scientists recently discovered a giant pool of water just floating out in space, like a big drop of water, except it contains 140 trillion times more water than all of our oceans combined. And the aliens from Oblivion and Independence Day that came all the way across the galaxy to kill us and drink up all our life-giving Earth oceans must have just, like, driven right by it without noticing the giant drop of water that's the size of, like, five of our suns, or I think it's actually, like, hundreds of our suns. Anyways, so this episode, we're kind of removing the assumptions we've all had drilled into us by movies and decades of crackpot alien sightings and UFO cultures. It's kind of long, so in case you want to jump around, we start off with that second type, the crackpot kind, the little gray guys with the almond-shaped eyes going around in the flying saucers you hear about on the History Channel and crazy people night at town hall meetings. We spend the first 15 minutes just kind of giving a brief history of that very specific type of alien and UFO, and, you know, they're all very similar, and conspiracy theorists point to this as a reason that they must be true, and we come up with some alternate explanations for why they're all so similar. And then after that, we look at Fermi's paradox, which is basically a question asked by this really smart Italian physicist. Talk about challenging assumptions, right? Smart Italian physicist. But Fermi claimed that based on the billions of planets around the billions of stars that we know about, mathematically, there should be so many instances of intelligent life that a big enough percentage of them should have discovered faster than light speed travel by now, and history should just be lousy with alien encounters. So the paradox is basically, hey, where's all the aliens? But with math. And so we kind of use that as a jumping off point to then go into kind of examine all the assumptions that we've been making about alien and what intelligent life means, what contacting that intelligent life would be like. We kind of remove the assumptions that have been limiting our thinking on that and kind of look at it from some angles you might not be used to looking at it from. And then we close out with just dessert, just a handful of our favorite first contact scenarios. You know, first contact with an intelligent life form would be like the greatest plot twist in the history of reality. And, you know, they're fun to think about. So we just shoot the shit about that for about a half hour, 45 minutes at the end. So stick around for that. And for footnotes, I will talk to you then. Her name is Yoshime. She's a black belt in karate. We've got on the phone Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, a best-selling author of John Dies at the End, and this book is full of spiders and many popular articles on the internet. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
And we have Abe Epperson, the director of many of the best videos we've ever run on Cracked and sort of co-created video on Cracked with Michael Swaim. Hello, Abe.
Hello, Jack. Nice to meet you, internet.
That was right? The biography I gave you, that's not the other guy?
No, that's absolutely
that's
right.
You. Yeah. You're the one.
I'm the one. And thank you for saying that I make the best videos, because that's also a truth.
All right. Today we're going to be talking about alien, extraterrestrial life, but scenarios that you don't really see in movies and TV shows as much. Jason, you gave kind of a nice, quick history in an email leading up to this call of sort of how the UFO culture started and suffered death by camera phone. You want to kind of take us through that?
Yeah, and I used to really be into UFOs as a teenager. But it was one of those things where, like a true believer, like I'd buy all the books. And like in the 80s, there was tons of this stuff. Like, you know, like there'd routinely be news stories and the sightings would come out and there are all these books written. There's a book called Communion by a guy named Whitley Strieber who had claimed to have been abducted multiple times. And this was all the rage for a long time. There was like some poll claiming there's like tens of thousands of people had been abducted by aliens or claimed they had an abduction story. So I had used to read obsessively about this stuff, and then over time, like in search of an actual plausible account, got more and more disappointed. And then as I grew up, like this was a real maturation thing for me, because I realized, oh, okay, these people are just telling themselves this. But the whole culture and like America's obsession with UFOs and all that, it basically goes back to the post-war years. And like the term flying saucer came from one single incident. It was in 1947, and there was a pilot, it was a commercial pilot, I think his name was Kenneth Arnold, who had claimed to have seen several UFOs. And then he was misquoted. He said that they were flying erratically, like they were skipping across the air, like if you took a saucer and skipped it across water, like, or a pie plate or something. But that the editor or whoever wrote the headline in the newspaper covering it had misquoted him as saying that the craft were saucer-shaped. And so they put the term flying saucer in the headline. And from then on, the alien spaceships were saucer-shaped. Like, that entered the culture that way. That one misquote, like all the way up to the movie Independence Day, when the aliens show up, they're in discs. And when people would like fake sightings, they would always do it with like a plate or a hubcap or something like that, because that was just accepted now, that when the aliens land in your backyard, they're going to be in this saucer-shaped thing, all because this one guy one time used the word saucer in his description of how they move.
Used the weirdest sort of metaphor for how something can move that I've ever heard. Skipping a saucer across water. Is that like an activity that, like pole sitting, that used to be popular in the 30s for some reason?
Right. I mean, like you've seen people skip, or you've heard of people skipping like flat stones across the water.
Sure.
I mean, like he was seeing something that wasn't there. It was a reflection on his windshield or something like that. So to his eyes, it was flying in an impossible way. It was bouncing through the air, right? But that's because it didn't exist. But the point being that, and like they asked him what they were shaped like, and he almost describes them as like a stealth fighter jet shape, like a boomerang type thing. But they were very thin and this impossible aircraft flying in an impossible way. But that's it. That's all it took for that to enter the culture and start a national obsession that lasted right up until the invention of cell phones, they had cameras on them. Because, you know, these existed purely in terms of, you know, in the form of fuzzy photographs, grainy photographs, and then just tons and tons of eyewitness testimony. But once the 2000s rolled around and everybody had a camera and a video camera in their pocket, that was it. That was the end of the UFO phenomenon. Because it used to be you could claim, I mean, people literally, some of these sightings, these encounters, they claimed like this thing sat down in their field behind their farmhouse, and the whole family was there, and these aliens came out and greeted them or whatever. Now, obviously, that actually happened. You would have 25 or 30 high-definition camera, you know, people shooting it on their iPhones, like, they, from every angle, there'd be no doubt that it happened, and obviously that hasn't, you know, that holy grail of UFO video has never occurred now. So you either have to believe that the aliens intentionally stopped visiting because they're afraid of our camera phones, which would be the lamest alien invasion thwarting strategy that anyone right. should have ever come up with, or you have to believe that it never existed. So the fact that it persisted for so long tells you a lot about how people think and about how these things sort of live on in the culture despite not having much of a basis. And it tells you a lot about how badly people want to believe.
You know, it makes sense to me, actually, the Messiah, or the idea of, like, one person being told by the aliens and choosing, hey, you're the one that's going to, like, in Carl Sagan's Contact, Jodie Foster is, like, chosen by the aliens to be the ambassador to Earth, kind of much in the same way that I think God did to Jesus or something, like the concept of this all-powerful being saying, like, if I just appeared, I'd freak everyone out, so I'm just going to let you be my message. And if that is true, so the guy who, like, claims that aliens, like, probed him and he's, like, picketing out in front of, like, Washington, the White House, he's your space messiah. He's the guy who aliens chose to be
right,
the one.
Right. With religion, you have the added thing that having faith is seen as a good thing, and so you have to have faith, and it's a test of faith for you to believe in the word of this guy who appears to be crazy, this prophet. You know, God sends his messages through people who society frowns on, but that's all part of the test, you know, the test of belief.
Right.
But with something as scientific as UFOs, it's like, wait, why are you guys only going, if you're trying to send us a message, why are you only going with our least trustworthy members? Like, that guy just appeared on Maury last week for a paternity suit, and now he's on the UFO episode. Yeah. Like, why did you go with him specifically?
And why is it that every single one of these guys look like Weird Al Yankovic? You know?
But the whole thing about the abduction, like, that element of it you're talking about, like, people getting taken up or contacted by, we actually mentioned in an article, the idea of aliens abducting people, like, as a fictional trope goes back forever, the same as the idea of monsters abducting people and King Kong and all that goes back forever. But the idea of it being a real thing that really happens goes back to 1961. And that was where that first image of the gray aliens came from, the big almond eyes, the big foreheads, like that. In our article, it had been pointed out that 2 weeks before that, or about 10 days before their abduction, there was an Outer Limits episode, which, if you're not familiar, is an old, like, Twilight Zone ripoff, a sci-fi anthology show that featured, like, that design of aliens. Like, it's not exactly that. It was a guy in a costume, but he had, like, the big forehead and then the big eyes and then the there's no nose or whatever. They, like, less than 2 weeks after that show airs, they get abducted by one of those, and then Spielberg uses that same design basically in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1977. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, you get abducted by an alien, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
So again, I like to think about what costume designer on that low-budget TV show invented an entire alien race that now, you know, you can't get out of your heads, because once that's what you see, when you have these things that scientists think lead to abduction experiences, sleep paralysis, whatever it is, you're now programmed to see that, whereas 1,000 years ago, they were programmed to see a demon or a succubus entering their right. bedroom or whatever. Right. But it's a lot of the same thing. It's getting whisked away to some other world. Usually there's some sexual element to it, mentioned, like the anal probing or whatever, or they want to, you know, you've got some message to bring to humanity, or they're breathing you with one of their kind. Like, those themes go back a long, long way, and UFO people use that as evidence. See, this has been going on forever, but, you know, science says, well, it's more likely the human brain works a certain way. When you're half asleep and you're hallucinating things, there's certain insecurities and certain fantasies that we all have, and they all sort of play out in a very similar fashion.
Yeah, there's the refrain from UFO specialists and experts that, well, why do all of the sightings look so much alike? And just in reading and editing our articles and doing research for this podcast, I feel like my best guess would be that it has something to do with, first of all, just how not just the human mind gets locked in on an idea, but a culture at large can get locked in on an idea and like sort of perpetuate that idea. Like if a newspaper reporter has heard that the aliens have the eyes that are far apart and, you know, they're little gray people, part of that is going to unintentionally bleed its way into his account of the story that this guy told him.
Like the 1950s zeitgeist almost gives credence to the theory by like jumping, like, my facts are just helping and supporting this hole that's already been true in this culture that's been around. It's interesting because, like, for a long time, aliens were only seen in, like, pop culture as a threat. This idea that the 50s was full of body snatching and days that, like, stood still. It's mainly, though, because Hollywood, I think, was making propagandist films during that era, like, specifically against the Red Scare. So this idea of assimilation and mind control were, like, hot topics. Right. So I thought it was interesting in researching that E.T. was really the first mainstream media where the aliens arrive and they're just not trying to kill us.
Right.
Like, that's interesting to me because that means for almost two decades, this was fairly prevalent in the zeitgeist and it was always they're going to mess us up or steal our America or something.
Yeah, and like while alien invasion movies continued to be popular, when I was into the UFO stuff in the 80s or so, it was all about that religious connotation that these are the saviors. They're here to save mankind from itself. That's what Communion was about. That's actually why he named the book that, because it was all about these aliens are trying to teach us a higher form of, you know, it was just a total substitution for, I guess, people that found the old religions boring. So these aliens were just the new angels. But that's why I find it interesting, because each time there's some gap that it's trying to fill. So before, when you needed an enemy to hate, the aliens were the enemy to hate, and then when people that weren't feeling spiritual anymore needed something else to sort of look toward some greater intelligence, then aliens filled that gap too. It's like this thing in our imagination that kind of is whatever we want it to be.
Yeah, we can make them represent Russians if we want to. We can make them represent a race that we don't want to admit that we're fearful of, or some aspect of our sexuality that is difficult for us to deal with in the alien movies. I don't know what that statement just implied about my sex life. It's nothing like the alien movies. But, you know, there's plenty of sexual imagery in those movies is what I mean to say. But I do want to...
Well, the abduction stories all have rape themes. Like, they're harvesting sperm from the males to breed a race of human-alien hybrids, or they're... The anal probing is a constant thing, but that's, you know, that's a common anxiety among males, like being abducted and anally probed. But there's something that about the fact that the men that this happens to, like, they immediately run to the newspapers to tell them about it. Like, it's a strange, I don't know. It's
like bragging culture.
So I do want to talk about, because we've been talking about sort of the easy to dismiss questions around aliens and the prospect of extraterrestrial life. But there's this thing called the Fermi paradox. It's named after Enrico Fermi, I don't know, it sounds Italian to me, hopefully. Who was a scientist at Los Alamos in 1950, where all the dope physicists hung out. And they started talking about sort of all the UFO sightings that were popping up around that time, right after the war, presumably for the reasons Jason was talking about. But they started doing math and trying to figure out how likely it is that a, you know, intelligent civilization would discover faster than light speed travel. And he estimated, you know that, I think it might be a comic or like an illustration or something where like a guy's like doing a puzzle and the puzzle is him doing the puzzle as he puts it together, and then the last piece is a killer behind him about to kill him, and that's the last thing he ever sees. I like to think that's how Fermi's paradox came about. He was doing the equation of like how likely it is that there would be extraterrestrial life in the universe. And then as he like wrote the answer out, the answer was there should be aliens here already, and they're probably right behind you. And he like turned around and that was the last thing he ever saw. But that is essentially what the conclusion they came to, is that there are so many habitable planets and just so many planets out there, so many stars with planets around them out there, that it's almost a mathematical impossibility that we would be the only intelligent race. So where is everybody? Why haven't they stopped by and said, what's up?
I've had this thought for a while, which is that astronomy is like baseball. Some people who understand it love it and find it, everything about it interesting and amazing. And then there's like basically everyone else who think every new crazy breakthrough through in science is just kind of bullshit. Like water on Mars. I have friends who are just like, oh, well, cool. Is it like a rainforest or something? No. We just found traces of water on Mars. Oh, is it like a river? Like they just not really
getting
it.
Well, because I think for those of us who aren't interested in each little breakthrough, we were raised on movies, you know, mm-hmm. and our minds have been ruined by that. We're right. like, where? Well, was E.T. there? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah,
it's just water. I assumed that there was, like, you know, oceans on other planets because right. James Cameron movies said so.
And it's possible, but I think First Contact will kind of be the same in that, as we do, like, a spacefaring race would most likely realize that sending out robots would, like, be way smarter than sending their people.
Right.
So most likely our first contact will be, like, a piece of space trash or, like, a computer program or something like that, if it actually ever occurs like that. Not, like, knock, 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 here, we're right at your doorstep, and by the way, we're here with all of our ships
right.
and saucers.
Yeah, so that's one sort of answer to that question of it's mathematically almost impossible that we're alone. Why haven't we heard from anyone? One answer would be, well, we've only been looking for a very, very short period of time. And you always hear that thing about when you look at the amount of time that humans have been on this planet, it's like a blink compared to how long dinosaurs or the mountains or the moon. There was a time 9 million years ago where the day was like 18 hours long and the moon was super close. It was like this giant thing that took up most of the sky at night, and we weren't there for that, but who's to say that the smart extraterrestrial aliens didn't come by Earth and visit then? Like there's absolutely no reason that their period of peak, you know, space travel would line up with this moment in time.
When you talk about a UFO coming to visit Earth with aliens inside of it to look at us, there's like 1,000 assumptions you're making there
yeah.
that don't necessarily have to be true. Like the fact that they are approximately the same size as humans when we are the size we are due to very specific things about the gravity here. Organisms that are too big just don't do all that well, although even though dinosaurs dominated for millions of years. But so, for instance, like I wrote off the whole thing as like this crackpot theory. I mean, the government funded a project in the 60s called Project Blue Book specifically to find out, like they hired experts to find out, are we being visited by aliens? Because it was a national security issue. It's like, well, do we need to be worried about this? And I think part of it was they were also secretly worried that these were Soviet experimental aircraft. So like when they say get to the bottom of it, they were just basically saying, as the government does, look, just tell us, we just want to know one way or the other. So they took the idea very seriously for a long time and then discovered that no, there were literally no plausible reports. But looking back at it, like the idea that the aliens would be here in little ships made of metal, even just 50 years later, for instance, we have like the Hubble telescope that can get these super clear images across billions of miles of space. The fact that the aliens, in order to see what we're doing, would need to fly down and land in your yard, that assumption by itself, if they're that advanced, they may not need to get within millions of miles of Earth to see what's going on Earth. And that's just one of the thousands of things that could completely render the idea of little aliens and little physical spacecraft ridiculous, because we have such a narrow idea of what this would look like, and it's basically like 99% of what we would do, build, you know, how humans would do it.
Right,
but it's crazy to assume that it would look anything like that.
Yeah. As we looked at, like, strange forms of, like, there's, like, chemotropes in the heat vents at the bottom of their oceans, and they, like, bleed arsenic, and, like, they just have nothing to do with us at all. It makes us realize that aliens will most likely have very little in common with us, like, biologically and psychologically. Like, the human race is programmed to hate organisms that, like, don't look like us, like cockroaches and snakes and spiders and stuff. We want to kill them. So most likely we'd have like a mutually assured destruction if we even met, because we'd be like, oh no, don't like what you are. Or it would be like a District 9-esque thing where we just like put them in shanty towns and just try to forget about them as much as possible.
I'm going to get to a theory that has to do with parallel evolution later on, but just before we like kind of jump forward into that, I do think that Abe's idea of like the first thing we find is a piece of space trash is really interesting, because that seems like the most likely scenario to me that could happen in our lifetime, is we just find evidence of life on a nearby planet, an organism like the things living in the heat vents or whatever. But in terms of like signs of an intelligent civilization, just like something that was cast off, you know, like the very first sound that humanity sent out into space happened 100 years ago, and I'm sure it wasn't like super well planned. Like an electromagnetic wave is going to be the first thing to, it's only gone 100 light years away at this point, and the most optimistic estimation of the nearest planet that might have a intelligent civilization on it is like 1,000 light years. That's like, if they're just all over the place, if the galaxy is lousy with intelligent civilizations, 1,000 light years away would be like the first time you could reasonably expect that. So the first evidence that there's anything approaching a civilization on Earth won't reach that point until the year 3000 AD.
It's so large that the idea of actually finding a physical like talisman that says, here's aliens, look, they made this thing and they have the writing on it, it's much more likely that we hear or see something off in the distance.
Yeah.
Just because that's the best we can do. Like that's our best tool, is looking.
Right, looking.
Yeah.
Like if intelligent life exists out there, they have no reason, like even if they have light speed travel, they have no reason to like point it at us, or like if they have the ability to like see us and zoom in on us on our, they have no reason to point it at us, because the evidence that we are an intelligent civilization won't have reached them for many hundreds of years.
But I think what you just said there, intelligent civilization, like this is where we sort of can't get out of our own heads. You know, squirrels consider each other to be intelligent, but we don't consider squirrels to be intelligent. So in every scenario, from invasion scenarios to the day the Earth stood still, no matter how aggressive the aliens are or how benevolent they are, they're always treating us as fellow sentient beings, as if that's a thing, because this human concept that only humans are truly alive and everything else on Earth is either food or a bug you can step on, or you know, a chimp you can experiment on, like only humans are true, you know, life, only humans have souls, only humans have the spark of like sentience. The idea that the aliens would have the same standard makes no sense whatsoever, because if they are as much more intelligent than us than we are to squirrels, then they would treat us as squirrels. There's no reason they wouldn't. You know, just the way a species treats a member of another species, it always works a certain way. And you're either food, or you're a pet, or you're a bug to be squished. Or they can, you know, they can take care of you, they can feel sort of stewardship over you or whatever. But the idea that they would treat us as equals, we would had to have had evolved to be so incredibly similar. Like, we don't even treat chimps as equals, and they are not very far away from us.
Right.
But we don't hesitate to, you know, experiment on them or kill them or do whatever. Like, they don't have any sort of rights. We don't recognize anything about their right to live or anything like that whatsoever. So it's not that the aliens would be evil or would be menacing or anything of the sort. It's that they wouldn't even consider us at all. Like, our opinion, you know, in the same way that a squirrel's opinion doesn't matter to you, our opinions wouldn't matter to them. There'd be no reason for them to deal with us.
Yeah, one of my favorite books in the science fiction realm is Speaker for the Dead, which is basically a big treatise about how do we qualify intelligent life and how do we coexist with life forms with strange rituals or behaviors that we might perceive as threats. And that's kind of like what happened in the first book, Ender's Game, where it's like, oh, we didn't even know that you were like alive, much less intelligent, and now, so we killed a lot of you, sorry. And then since we're humans and we hold grudges, we're like, well, we got to retaliate, you know? Like, and that's an affectation of humanity. So therefore, we just destroyed each other. And in Speaker of the Dead, I love it because there's like the concept of like a guy who, oh, I don't have like a life cycle and a death cycle like you. I live as this, like a larva, and then I live as this, like monkey, and then I live as this tree. And then I don't really conceive of death in the same way that you do. So what I thought I was doing is a ritualistic, like, here, I love you so much, I respect you, so I'm going to murder you. And the us going, what? You, murder is bad, don't murder. And like, what? I don't know what you mean. I'm just letting you go to pass to this next life. Stuff like that, behaviors and rituals and things that psychologically are ingrained in the species itself, just like our propensity to retaliate because we're like, fuck you, revenge. You know, like,
right,
that kind of thing, I think, is exactly the type of the mismanagement and just what we wouldn't get if we were next to an intelligent life form. Exactly what you're saying, Jason. Just like, I find that that's probably the most fascinating thing is we could take all the smartest scientists and artists in the room and they wouldn't even be able to think about the types of qualities of life and what those life forms would think were important. You know, obviously there's like resources and stuff like that, food and, you know, reproduction, but like what they would consider a threat or what they would consider a way of being, you know, respectful would be completely out of proportion of what we consider it to be.
And a lot of our values that we think of as it just being sort of fundamental to the universe are not only things that none of the rest of the animal kingdom shares,
right,
but there are things that humans didn't even necessarily share until, you know, there was a time not very far in human evolution where the idea of it being wrong to enslave another human or whatever just hadn't entered anybody's mind. Like, this is a recent concept we came up with, and then in the animal kingdom among predators, like the idea of killing another animal in a way that's merciful or trying to minimize the amount of pain the gazelle feels just isn't, that's a foreign concept. Like, it's that almost would have to seem like to us like some bizarre ceremony that they perform in some other cultures. Like, why, this is food, this is walking food here, I have to eat or I'm going to die. What are you talking about being merciful? What are you talking about to try to not be cruel in how you hunt? Like, that's a modern human idea that we invented, the idea that aliens would, and again, this isn't even playing into the Hollywood thing where the aliens are all like being bombastic and we're going to take your planet from you and you're, like, it's not even that. It's that it wouldn't even, the way you don't even think about the pain of the plants you're eating, you eat a salad, you don't sit there and think, gosh, I hope this lettuce didn't suffer. I hope in whatever ways lettuce feels pain that it didn't feel anything when we harvest it. Like, it just doesn't enter your mind.
Lettuce is always screaming. It's just screaming while you're eating salad.
You know, in their world, it's just a nonstop hell of being continually eaten and turned into salads by humans. So, they just hate us so much.
So that was kind of what I had always assumed, and it actually made the prospect of extraterrestrial life less interesting to me, because it was this, why wouldn't they just be a gaseous fart cloud that like can think and reason, and we just wouldn't even be able to like see them, like we could cross paths with them and like not even have any sense of having discovered intelligent life. The thing that made me think that might not be the case is this idea of parallel evolution. When we look back at evolution, like, it's easy to be like, well, you know, look at all the different ways that we branched off and could have taken one of any thousands of twists and turns along the way. This is just a chance that we happen to end up like this. But I don't think that's how evolution works.
Not at all.
Because of, like, this idea of parallel evolution. Like, it's more that the environment shapes you to, like, this isn't functionally how it works, but overall, when you step back and look at it from the standpoint of millennia, the environment and the function that you have to take in that environment to survive shapes you to look a certain way. And in sci-fi movies, like, aliens come out and they have, like, you know, their octopuses who, like, slither around on the ground. But that's probably not how aliens get around on the ground at least on a planet made of land, because we've had millions and millions of animals on Earth that
realize feet would be a good answer.
Right. Feet is the best way to get around. For people who don't really know what parallel evolution, another good example is the flying squirrel and the Australian version of the flying squirrel, which I don't know the name of, but these creatures that we know as flying squirrels are basically squirrels that their skin can turn into, like, one of those flight suits, yeah, you know, that, like, people, you see, like, crazy ass X Games type extreme sports people flying around in. Well, flying squirrels have those just, like, built into their body. And there is one of those in Australia as well, but it's a totally different species or whatever. Like, it's not a mammal. It's a marsupial. It's a thing that doesn't come out of its mother in a placenta. It goes into a little pouch. But everything else, like, to the naked eye is the same. It's just its insides are totally different. So on totally opposite sides of the globe, they came up with something that is just completely ridiculous looking, but it's the exact same thing, took that same exact weird-ass form on totally opposite sides of the globe because the environments shaped it that way. There was a way to survive using that in both places. So from that standpoint, like, we're most of the scientific search for extraterrestrial life is looking for these Goldilocks planets, right? Like, these planets that are similar to Earth, like, they're in the same general band of distance from the sun that could sustain water and, you know, that humans could theoretically inhabit. So it's really interesting to me the idea that those planets, while they might not currently have life on them, could have at one time had something very similar to a human civilization rise up that is just different from humans in the sense that, like, you know, they don't come out in placentas or whatever.
Maybe they have a little more radiation, so they have an organ that deals with that, right, or something, like, you know. Like,
yeah, they have a kangaroo pouch that they keep their young in.
But ultimately, whatever, they figure out, oh, I should have little peepers that connected to my little brain thing, and that lets me interpret and see the world. I think that that's absolutely true that we'd have. But remember, as Jason was saying, we're looking for a subset. I mean, the Goldilocks thing is an important thing because it's, can we live there? Because we need another planet someday. Or, and also, hey, do we have friends in the universe? Going and trying to search for gaseous clouds of, you know, sentience is not going to help us that much because we'll be like, hey, what's up? Oh, hey, what's up? You're over there. I'm over here. We have nothing to do. We're so far different. But someone like a monkey guy who's, like, on this other planet that I may be able to coexist with because we kind of came up through the same kind of stimuli that formed us and evolved us all through, you know, natural selection. That kind of thing might actually have some cohesiveness to some semblance of what we consider, oh, you, I understand that your life and I understand that there's a lot of similarities there. And in fact, the more similar we are is probably the luckier we are. So I think that's a smart thing that we'd be searching for Goldilocks planets only. Because mainly we just need a planet to get off. Like, this one will
we're
die.
We're almost done with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is a funny thing that, like, all the aliens in Hollywood movies, they, like, come to Earth and want to kill us because of our resources.
They want water.
Like, if we had light speed travel, we could go find, like, space is lousy with water. There's a place in space that is just a giant, like, it's the size of, you know, a million Pacific Oceans that's just floating out there, just a big pool of water that, like, our resources aren't so special. Like, everything in space is made of what Earth is made of.
Basically, stars that look like our stars and are in our range of development, there's most likely, because there's only like hundreds of so, you know, 100 plus elements, and there's about 100 billion stars just, you know, nearby. Just the idea that in the combinations of the elements, most stars that look like our stars have that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like oxygen and carbon and stuff around, you know, like it's so out of proportion to assume, just probability wise, that there wouldn't be something like some solar system that not just feels like our, you know, ours, but looks exactly like our solar system.
Right. And like, I mean, this isn't really parallel evolution, but I do think that I guess I reject the idea that like the smarter you get, the more likely you are to treat other animals like shit and just like not notice the similarities or the signs of intelligence in them. Like, it seems like the more we discover about science, the more likely we are to actually find similarities. Like, ants do enslave other ants, like, yeah, and they like conduct war in ways that are extremely similar to human beings.
That's actually that's my favorite example of evolution. Is a lot of people confuse and think that, well, bees and wasps, they look alike, so they're kind of like the same thing, right? And they couldn't be farther from the truth. In fact, wasps are bee killers. What happened is their wasps are closer to ants, so it's basically like ants that just got wings kind of idea. And the reason they look like, you have things like yellow jackets and stuff like that, is because they wanted to they started to look like bees so that they could infiltrate the hive. So it's like one of those examples of evolution making something similar because their life cycle synced up, because another organism exists out there and I look like this because I want to kill that more efficiently. It has very little to do with being the same as that or having anything to do with it. It almost always has to do with what makes me survive more, you know?
Right. In that specific environment.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as the idea of like there being another exact Earth-like planet, I mean, statistically, there has to be, right? Like, there's enough planets somewhere out there. There's a planet that's exactly the right distance from its star, has the right amount of water. Sheer odds, as many planets as there are, one of them or multiple ones have the same conditions as Earth, and would have to be around the same age as Earth. In other words, in the same stage of its development. So if your idea is that in the same environment with the same elements, really similar life would come about, if that's true, then that means that it's almost certain that there is something out there, right, that kind of qualifies. But I would have two arguments that I think kind of indicates how we still are very, like, human-centric in our thinking. Like, we're still thinking of the Earth as the center of the world and as humans as, like, the center of creation. One is that humans are not the dominant species on Earth. You know, for every one human, there are 10 million insects. The dominant species on Earth is some sort of beetle, or you could also say bacteria and microbes. Like, you could very much make the argument that humans primarily serve as a host for the true dominant species, which are, like, viruses. So the idea that, like, we look at Earth and see, like, cities and stuff we've built and the way we can change the landscape and think, yes, this is what Earth was all about, was giving birth to humans. But we make up a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the biomass on Earth and are not actually terribly relevant to the ecosystem here. So it's almost the same as saying that intelligent life would have had to have formed on that planet as saying that this specific type of beetle would have had to have had evolved there, or a certain type of virus would have to have evolved there. Because when you put it like that, it's like, well, but the odds are, like, it could have went extinct. It's like, right, humans are one of millions of species on this planet. The idea that the planet's goal is to evolve intelligent life is no more valid than saying that the planet's goal is to evolve life, to finally come up with a life form that has 10 legs instead of 8 or instead of 6. Like, it's a specific trait of our species that isn't any more necessarily any more special than any others. We treat that like this is the thing that the universe is made for, is to give birth to things that can think and can build spaceships. And there's not necessarily any reason to believe that. But right. The other part is,
I was just going to jump in there to say that I'm not saying that those Goldilocks planets aren't teeming with life. And I think that's very likely that we're going to find that possibly within our lifetime, just a planet that has life that where people are going to be disappointed because we can't talk to any of the life because it's a bunch of different, you know, organisms that are maybe they're amoeba, you know, maybe we can't understand the at first, like all the complex ways they've organized. But I do think that the idea of intelligent life that you can actually communicate with and that would have this urge. You're right. Like maybe the urge to travel into space is just some specific bacteria that's in our bowels that's like telling us to do that. But I guess my argument would be that if there's another species that has that same drive, that it might be very similar. It might be a human-ish species with a similar bacteria in its bowels that's telling it to travel into space or whatever. But Jason, I cut you off there.
The other point side of it was, even if we gave you everything, like say that the creatures that evolved are humans, like say they were us down to the cell. For instance, like say I could just take a bunch of humans and put them on a different planet 10,000 light years away, and say we did that 10,000 years ago, right? Because like their evolution isn't going to match us perfectly. Like it's not going to be like they're like we talk about. Well, they may their you know technology may be like 1,000 years in the future. Well, evolution works on a much longer timeline than that. Like we probably would have missed each other by like 1,000,000 years. But even if it was very very close, let's say that we grabbed humans that lived half the humans that lived on Earth 10,000 years ago and transported them to this other planet, and their culture grew up separately, completely separate from ours. I think even they, an isolated population, completely disconnected from all of our cultural things, including our religions, including all of our cultural heritage, our shared dreams, all that stuff, just living on a completely different environment with different flora and fauna and, you know, a different part of the galaxy, I think even they would be almost impossible to communicate with if we then got in contact with them in 2014. I think even their languages, mannerisms, values, all those things, like even if the physical evolution had followed step by step, their cultural evolution would be so alien to the point that, like, we had an article talking about time travel. If you could go back just 200 years, it would be utterly impossible to talk to anyone, even a fellow English speaker, because that language has changed so much and the idioms have changed so much. Like, it would be so difficult to live in your day-to-day life in almost anywhere because it's so different. Like, your manner, your hygiene, like, everything would be so weird to them. And if you keep rolling that back, go back 1,000 years, 1,500 years, you know, to biblical days, so many things just wouldn't make sense to you that we can't imagine what the differences would be, and that's the point. Because even if we contact, like, some isolated tribe in the Amazon, we still basically know what's going on with them, and we can sort of, like, find some rudimentary way to communicate with them. But to the gap between that and somebody who grew up on, or that came to their whole culture came to pass on a completely different planet, it's just something different altogether. And it's hard to even start to inventory, like, all of the differences there would be.
I like the idea that we, like, in a lot of scientists' minds, their greatest hope is that we find this, you know, culture, like you said, that has nothing to do with us culturally or whatever, but all we do is we just send a bunch of guys over and they just, like, do math together. Like, that's the best case scenario because it's the only universal language, I guess.
I mean, it would have to, if we ever met someone in space, I do think we would have to have that thing in common, right? That we both are into science.
Yeah, we
in
figured some it
way.
Out. Yeah.
Like, yeah, we got there some way. Like, they didn't just, like, jump there or whatever.
And if there's some kind of stimuli, like, because obviously if they have a voice or they can, if we have some kind of narrow band of or frequency that we can actually, like, communicate, the first things that would be communicated is, so this is one, and this is two, and this is the concept of zero. And that's where you'd start. I mean, because anything else would be like, I don't know what you mean. Like,
yeah.
That makes no sense to me.
And now I realize how stupid this sounds, because I never would have believed this to be true. But the thing you're saying, Jason, about, like, that experiment where we had planted human life on a planet that was mostly similar to Earth, you know, similar enough to sustain human life over the period of time that ours has sustained human life. I think the cultures would be surprisingly similar. When you saw the solutions that they came up with, they would be surprisingly similar. And it's a thing that sounds stupid. It sounds like I'm being limited and I'm just like, well, I can't imagine any other version of this culture. And that's not the case. It's a super like counterintuitive thing that like you have to like kind of force your mind to get around this idea that like we've seen that experiment played out on different continents, really. I mean, it really is. It does come down to how different the planet's environments are, right? But if they were like somewhat similar, think about all the different choices each individual animal could have made that, or like all the different adaptations they could have come up with that would have led to them being dissimilar, but they ended up looking and like using almost the exact same sort of means of survival on Australia as they did over here, even though those creatures were nothing alike to begin with.
Because just like you're saying, yeah, we've seen this great experiment with different continents, even though they have a very common ground, i.e., you know, like, the ground is common, you know, like, but also this concept of, like, we have the building blocks of our life, like, DNA and the idea of, like, a nitrogen base, we just assume that those are the only combinations that work and that can create something that will then want to reproduce, and unlike a virus, but, you know, like a human would eventually, or an organism that we consider a life form. It could be 9 base pairs. It could be a silicon-based life, and we could actually see them. We could, you know, they're all in the EM spectrum, you know, like we could visit this planet that's an arsenic-based life form. We have no idea because it's just, that's foreign concept to us. And we're like, well, it wouldn't work because then what would they eat? And, you know, and what would they drink? And to us, it's like, well, you know, if you like nitrogen and you like oxygen, water's your thing. But it could be that there's something super prevalent like sodium bromide or something like that, that is exactly the kind of thing that they need. So there's just a planet full of that. And they're just kicking around like us with brains like ours, but just wired completely differently.
Like if the very first building block of life is different, yeah, that would seem like that would send things down a different path.
Well, I mean, at the beginning, it was all soup anyway, right? So who's to say what?
Literally soup, I believe.
Yeah, we were a certain type of soup.
We're not saying different things, but let me give you an analogy. When you hear people argue about global warming, okay, what I will hear from people who say it's no big deal is, look, we're only talking about a 2-degree or 3-degree average difference. We're talking about, you know, only a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent in the difference in the atmosphere. We're only talking about, like, the ecology, the overall Earth environment, even in the worst-case global warming scenario, will still be 99.9% of the same as it was before. See, these people are being crazy. And the other side will say, no, this will be a completely radical change. It will change rainfall patterns. It will change, you know, growing seasons. It will, you know, flood cities or whatever. It sounds like they're saying two very opposite things. They're not. The alarmist side is still saying things are going to be 99.9% the same. But that 0.01% difference
changes everything.
To the Earth is to us absolutely unlivable. So a species, because we have developed in this very super ultra specific niche where we depend on certain rainfall patterns, certain weather patterns, we have certain arable land that we grow crops on, we rely on our terrain exactly there at exactly certain times of the year, we rely on these exact ocean currents to deliver winter to Europe at exactly the right time, not earlier, not later, and so on. Like, we don't realize that what is a tiny, tiny, tiny difference to the geology and the universe itself is to us, to our brains, a massive, massive difference. So we can run into an organism that is 99% like us, specifically a chimpanzee or whatever, and see it as a completely different, like, the concept of a species, that's, we invented that idea, that they are different species. Like, that's a human invention, that concept of different, we're different things. So to us, the differences between us and them, like they're sitting in their cage throwing poop at tourists at the zoo, is a radical difference, where in the grand scheme of things, it's really not. So if you ran into a species that culturally and physically was 99.9% like us, to us would still be, like, evolutionarily, to us it would be a radical difference to the point where we may not even recognize them.
NASA commissions consulting astronomers to think up possible alien planets and life forms. So our tax dollars are going to, like, these LSD-fueled, like, artists thinking up space bugs. and that's an actual thing that happens. That
I would love it if everything they came back with was just, like, sexy alien face, like three boobs, and, like, like, on this planet, men are just sex slaves being held in chains and forced to pleasure the...
Three boobed
fantasies.
Yeah, the space fantasies of a 14-year-old in the midst of puberty.
Yeah. Now, going to the pro-alien side, let me throw out a specifically very creepy science fiction scenario for you. When people in a zoo or in a preserve will, like, try to raise a panda from a baby or try to raise a condor from a baby or whatever, they have ways they can convince the other, because they are so much more intelligent than the creatures, they have all sorts of tools for convincing the creature that they are one of them, right? Like, they will let you feed them because you can either make yourself look like its mother or smell like its mother. And out in the wild, even, you know, in many cases, if you can make yourself smell perfectly like another gazelle, you could walk around the gazelles, and they're so dumb they just don't, because that's how they're built to recognize. Like, they can smell a lion, and they know it's a lion, and they know to be alarmed. But otherwise, so it's very easy to fool them and to become one of them in a way that is absolutely impossible for them to detect. So if there was another species that wanted to study us the way we study gazelles or the way we study rare birds or whatever, if they're that much smarter than we are to the animals, they would absolutely have ways to walk among us in ways that are absolutely undetectable. Either we would not see them at all, or else we would mistake them for fellow humans. But the way we always portray it in movies, and that the aliens are sort of, like, very clumsy in how they do it, like, they don't know how to mimic human emotion, or they don't understand love, or they're very robotic. Like, that's another very, like, we're kind of insulting the aliens when we assume that they'd be smart enough to come here, and they'd be a much higher intelligence, but they wouldn't know how to mimic any of our, like, social cues. Okay, just as we know how to, like, smear, you know, animal urine over our own bodies in order to pass among them, they would totally know how to imitate love and charisma and all of those things. So I think if they were here and watching us, I think it would be, if they're that much more advanced than we are, we would never know they were here. We would not be capturing their ships on freaking camera phones or whatever. They would pass through among us completely undetected, and we would never know until they chose to let us know.
And the thing I love about that analogy is that the way we're tricking those animals is... it's not very complicated. We're not doing a good job. We're just, like, sort of doing some weird little trick in their mind that makes them think, oh, yeah, that's another one. It just, like, I don't know how their brain processes it. Like, it just looks a little different. But I love the idea that, like, we would find out, and, like, it would be like the twist ending of a movie where you're like, yes, of course, it's the people who did that differently than everyone else. They were just, like, had figured out, in the same way scientists who live among gazelle figure out a little trick that, like, their brain can't wrap itself around. Like, the aliens have just, like, kind of figured out some hole in human perception that just can't figure out that they're lizard people or something.
We even mentioned in an article that, like, they did an experiment to see what a turkey wouldn't have sex with. And eventually they got all the way down to a wooden stick with a severed turkey head on it,
yeah.
And the male turkeys would still try to mate with it, because they could only, like, for whatever reason, their little pea-sized turkey brains, if it has that head on it, you figure, well, it's got to be a turkey. I don't care what the rest of it looks like. And so he would just start trying to mount it. to us, we laugh at that because it's like, oh, it's so, they're such simple creatures, but we can't conceive that we're simple creatures to something else because we're so used to the idea that we're at the top of the heap intelligence-wise that we can't even conceive of. It's like, well, we would eventually figure it out. It's like, no, not if they were to us as we are to turkeys. Everything we do that we think is smart would be the equivalent to humping a stick with a severed head on it to them.
Like, what if adolescence is all just the aliens, that experiment being played on all of us for a certain period of our time? Because I think most adolescent males aren't above humping inanimate objects during that, like, 3 years of their life. I certainly was not. The sort of reveal, like, just, like, pull the mask away, we've been here amongst you all along. I do think that if we assume that there are aliens observing us, there are aliens traveling through space. The one thing we have to assume about them is that they have some value of science, gaining knowledge, right? And in which case, I do think that that is the most likely way they would encounter humanity or would already be encountering us, as studying humanity to learn from them as a species, because, like, that's what science does, and you can always gain better ways to exist if you know more about the world and, like, other worlds, you know.
Well, they're either conquerors or they're scientists, really. If their objective is not just, if they're not just floating by, their objective is to go to this place, to go to this part of the Milky Way, to do this, to do that.
Yeah, but the conquerors thing, I guess I don't think that the more scientific you get, the more likely you are to become like this spacefaring, you know, light speed traveling creature. Seems like you're beyond the point of like being like, me conquer you for your gold.
I don't think it's that. I mean, we kind of touched on it about how there's just like oxygen and water everywhere. But like, is it necessarily on a planet, though? You know, and like, so there is some scarcity to what exactly the Earth is. And I would say that if we have the propensity to have, like, conquer and be assholes in general, just imagine a really super evolved version of us. It might not be Starfleet, where everyone's like a utopian, like, everything's great, and we have this prime directive that means that we don't like influence other cultures. That we don't necessarily see that as true. It could be a very like a regime that is essentially like, we need to move in. We just need to move in, because I do think that there is some scientific credence to that thought.
And science advances for the preservation of the species.
Right.
Our species, not anybody else's. So while we feel like, as we get more enlightened, like want to preserve the great apes and to put them on the endangered list, that's because we've dominated them, and now we can feel that if apes started taking over large parts of America, Planet of the Apes style, we would start slaughtering them wholesale. Like, if an ape moves into your apartment, you don't just let it live there. Like, you call animal control and they'll come shoot it with something and drag it away. We still maintain dominance, and we allow ourselves to be gracious toward them because we can, because we're dominant and they're not threatening to take anything from us. But for instance, rats eat a large part of our food supply, and we murder them every chance we get. We poison them, we trap them, we kill, because we're not going to let them fight us for resources or anything like that, because they're another species. And ultimately, all of this science, all this exploration is all about advancing humanity. So we arrive at that other planet that, you know, he talked about, where if we've ruined Earth and we need some other planet to move into, we find somebody else there. History makes it very clear what will happen to the people that are there if they're weaker than us. We will make a lot of noise about living with them, and we will talk very kindly about living with them and come up with some arrangement for sharing their planet with us. But if they tell us we're not allowed to move in there, we're moving in anyway. That's pretty much
right.
The way it works.
We're spacefaring. We kind of are better at this whole science thing than you guys.
We got here. You didn't get to Earth. Sorry, we are the invaders alien movie. We're sorry to tell you this. We're actually going to park our human ship over your alien White House and blow it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, yeah. As we're, like, debunking all these biocentric viewpoints, we're still biocentric in even this, because the assumption of all of our scenarios so far have been, we have something they want. I think it's kind of a presupposition to assume that we even have things that they would even care about. There's a Harlan Ellison has a terrifying short story that's kind of famous, "I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream." And that's about a supercomputer that destroys humanity but keeps five people alive. And just, if you're this powerful, if you can just, like, wipe out a genocide an entire planet, or if you're powerful enough to fly through space and just, "I'm just going to kick it here or there," you have solved things like resources. You have solved things like going faster than light travel. You really are winning the game. So what would this, like, super, you know, whether it be a god or a supercomputer, what would they do? And what Harlan Ellison said in this short story is he would just, like, kind of treat us as playthings. So what he does is he takes, like, this team of scientists, and he takes, like, one of them happens to be, like, really good looking and gay. And so what he does is he turns him into an ape with a huge penis, and he makes him, like, rape all of the other ones. And there's, like, a woman who is known as a prude. And, like, he understood every aspect, or it understood every aspect of what humans were. And is just messing around with humanity to try to, like, find out what's going on. So he makes people feel pain. He makes people feel, like, just not absolute apathy. He, like, just changes all the functions of us. And then my favorite part of the story, though, is that one of the guys, he just does nothing. So that all of them hate him a lot. Like, and he actually does give them, like, paranoia and stuff, because he assumes, like, "They're gonna kill me. Today's the day." It's just this terrifying horror story of,
he,
like,
has to give him paranoia in that
scenario. Yeah, Jesus. Guess, exactly.
Just like leaving him there and letting him exist among that seems like the worst possible thing you could do to that guy.
Yeah, I just thought it was a singular example of, like, in terms of our science fiction writers. All of our science fiction is kind of beholden to this concept that we're in a struggle, and yeah, they may be better than us, and it's, but there's some kind of inequality, but we're on the same spectrum or the same plane that, like, we have to fight, and I'm going to pull out a gun and you're going to pull out a better gun. But that is a whole assumption upon itself, just the idea that, yeah, there's hyper-intelligent life and can get around the galaxy and the universe just easily. If that's true, like, there's no even spectrum where we're even relevant, you know, like, or even that Earth is relevant. Everything's so abundant everywhere to him or it that why would it matter? And therefore, our alien scenario could just as well be something where it's like, yeah, you are just a you don't care, but you're totally a god to us. I think that's equally as possible as, I don't know, the movie Battleship.
they just rope off Earth and make it a zoo.
Yeah.
Because that's literally all the ability we have to fight back is the same ability that, like, the geckos at the zoo in their little glass cage have to fight back. Now at the zoo, now we're all going to come visit it and find amusing ways to mess with you.
There's this one theory that says that basically, any civilization is going to self-destruct within a certain period of time if it's sort of left isolated, and that the only way to really sustain any life form beyond that natural arc that we're presumably currently in the process of as the human species is to, like, meet up with another species, because then you're, like, trading notes, you know, figuring, you both invented totally different kinds of math that got you here, and, like, you can sort of work with each other and become sort of a better community by kind of learning from one another. And I think that's super unlikely to happen for the reasons we were talking about, with the chances that, like, two similar species would be in the same general area of the galaxy at around the same time, the same, like, kind of blink of existence that each species is likely to have is hugely unlikely. But I could see a scenario where, like, as an advanced civilization is, like, dying out, they just broadcast their history, or, like, everything that they've learned, basically. Because, like, if you think about it, that would be, like, the most important thing to do if human civilization was, like, about to just go out. Just sending something out there for any other civilization to kind of learn from, you know, like, here is our entire history, yeah, and here's how we lived, it's impossible to say how, like, scientifically valuable that is, how valuable it is to, like, every thing having to do with like intelligence and like intellectual curiosity, seeing like an entire civilization go from beginning to end.
Right. That's totally possible. You put a power source and a radio tower essentially in space, and you project like this continuous message that's a pattern essentially that starts off with a beep, you know, like until you get to the point. Because like, think about like one of my favorite things is like in Disney, how they can, the Norman McLaren was one of the first animators, and he found ways just by movement and stuff to give like an affectation and a character to just a dot, you know? So the idea of this message being like, I'm going to start you at dots, and now I'm going to teach you my ABCs through these dots. And then by the end of it, you'll probably have developed a computer that now I can make sentences.
It would be like a great like joining of science and like the humanities, like the way that, you know, for a millennium, like nobody could figure out the ancient Egyptian like hieroglyphics. And like, so you have the liberal arts students working with scientists trying to figure out the language at first and then sort of evaluate its meaning and go through it for, you know, relevant lessons and learnings and stuff like that. I don't know. I think that could be incredibly interesting and valuable, and like it could give you everything you need to know to like get the species beyond where we're at because of different things that they learned in their totally different form of existence. Most of the stars that you see in the sky have been dead for millions of years. There's no reason to assume that this alien civilizations living around them would be any different, right?
Yeah, in fact, in Next Generation Star Trek, they had this similar scenario because there's an episode where they're searching for this thing because they think it's going to be like, oh, it's going to be a power source, it's going to be a super weapon. So Romulans and humans and like every species we've seen in the show, and they get to it and it's just a hologram, and it's a person that looks like kind of a very fundamental version of a person. It's like a very like, I have eyes and, you know, like, but I don't have a lot of facial like texture or cheekbones or, but anyway, I'm just like, by the way, we existed and we lived and we went through the stars for many millennia, and then we started to die out and we realized that there was no one around. We looked around and there just wasn't anyone. So what we did is we decided to spread our DNA across everything. And by the way, if you're reading this, you're us. And like, and so it's this, it's of course Star Trek going like,
oh
you're,
this is God.
Everyone is the same. Like we're all in it together, and Romulans are humans and everything is Cthulhu is not terrifying. We've touched on that topic a lot of like kind of a,
they just jerked off into a rocket.
Yeah, exactly.
sent it at Earth, and the rest is history.
Yeah. But I really like that concept of especially someone who, a species who exists and it just, it's out of range, that there was just no one that they could have had contact with. But fast forward to the future and you do, you know, yeah, it's just random.
It would be very sudden, you know, it's like for the same reason that we started making enough electromagnetic activity 100 years ago for it to start, you know, going out into space in such a way that like people are going to know we're here, or other civilizations are going to know we're here when it hits them. But it's only gone like 0.00001% the radius of the galaxy.
Yeah, you know? I mean, we have a pretty good idea that the universe is 13.7 billion years, but really that's still just the observable universe, you know, like at a certain point it just all turns into red and cosmic background radiation to us, and we feel like, oh, that must have been the Big Bang, and we just can't see further. There could be a different reason, and the universe is infinite, and that means that there's just, life is a common occurrence in the universe.
Jack, your whole thing about sending out the cautionary tale or whatever, like you're kind of saying that we've been inadvertently doing that, and that if we do like wind up having like a nuclear war or whatever, then our final broadcast would be like the news reports of that happening. So we would inadvertently have served as like a negative example to the universe.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, even if we don't sit down and record, hey, don't make our mistake, like, the message would still be loud and clear because they would see, like, the early broadcast messages from the Industrial Revolution or whatever all the way up to the nuclear missiles. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that's it. Let's not do any of those things that those people did.
Right.
Your ultimate purpose in the universe was to serve as a cautionary tale to others.
And then we'd all have to really start guarding. But like, if we got the message from that sort of message from another planet, I think we'd be much more cautious about what we put on TV, knowing that this was like millions of years forward. This was going to be our legacy to like other intelligent civilizations.
You just shoot reality television into the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those Maury Povich, those paternity test episodes where the you are not the father thing, like that will be the first thing they receive is. Okay, I've got one more scenario that I wanted. I realized we were going super long here.
That's all right.
But back when I was big into UFOs, this one was by far my favorite and by far the most plausible. Now, I'm not saying I believe this. I'm saying that at the time, it was by far, I thought, the most advanced and most logical of the theories that have been put forward. We've only explored about 2% of the ocean floor. So you could have a civilization larger than ours living down there, and we'd never know it. Talk about parallel evolution. And just as we don't explore the ocean floor because it's incredibly expensive, and there's nothing down there, and we are in no way, like, to go down deep to the deepest, but you've got to have a very expensive diving bell, very short trips, tremendous expense, and not a lot of point. You're just seeing a bunch of jellyfish and those freaking things that live down by the, like, there's not gold down there. And this is why most ships sink, it's just gone. Like, we don't go down and get it because it's so inhospitable. Well, likewise, the alien civilization, which is not alien at all, this parallel intelligent civilization that had developed under the ocean floor is just as expensive and difficult for them to come up here. So they are like the UFOs we see are their very expensive expeditions to come up and check out life on land. But it's the same way as we're just mildly curious about what the jellyfish are doing. They're just mildly curious about the weird structures and stuff we build up here on land. So for a while, this idea fascinated me, that you could have two parallel intelligent civilizations, but because we have two such radically different ecosystems on Earth, land and deep sea, that are difficult to visit for the same organism. I mean, there's stuff, you pull that stuff up just up to the upper levels of the ocean and it explodes because it has, evolved to live under tremendous pressure, right? Like, it's just, we can't live in each other's ecosystems. That's like now, that's always been my favorite alien invasion scenario, that they're visiting from like 3,000 miles away. it's not very far away at all, but we just never have run into each other.
And so their UFOs are, that's basically their submarines that we're seeing flying through the sky. Like, they've learned somehow. Yeah.
But in a way, just like, it's hard for us, because you develop where you develop, so if we can't, it's hard for us to get inexpensive to do the diving bell and, take the short trips down there. Why would we assume that it would be easy for them to come up here? You know what I mean?
Abe still scuba dives in a diving
bell. They just don't do it very often. Now, obviously, everything I said at the beginning of the call is still true. Like, actual UFO sightings have vanished with the invention of cell phones and everybody has cameras. So, I'm not saying it's true. It's just that that's always been now, like, my favorite contact scenario. It turned out that there's an undiscovered species under the sea that, just as you mentioned, there are these very similar traits that evolve in different land masses. Intelligence also developed underwater somewhere, and they've, I'm acting like this is a fringe. This was the premise of The Abyss, right? James Cameron.
Let me give you an alternate explanation for why they have disappeared. So most of the UFO sightings were right after World War II, when there would have just been tons of shit falling down into the trenches at the bottom of the ocean. They would just be getting rained on by these like sunken, torn to pieces ships and our dead, blown apart soldiers. And then we've gotten better at not sinking ships. And so they've just kind of cooled it. They're like, all right, well, those guys seem to have figured things out. And I think the fact that you believe that to be true, Jason, is really interesting. Fucking lunatic. Well, it's the M.I. Cricket letter. Ain't no one better. And when I'm on the microphone, you best to wear your sweater, cause I'm cooler than the polar bear's toenails. Oh, hell, there he go again, talking that shit. Bend corners like I was a curve. I struck a nerve, and now you're about to see the southern plague serve. All right, that was our conversation about extraterrestrial life. That was my favorite theory of how first contact will happen. That does seem like the most plausible to me, and it's also kind of what Abe was saying, that we're not going to find some advanced species that happens to be at their peak and just inventing Starbucks and computers on one of these Goldilocks planets, because that's just so incredibly unlikely that we would just happen to cross paths with them at the exact same point in evolution. I heard somebody describe it once as like, if you went walking down the Appalachian Trail, what are the chances that the person you would pass would have been born at the exact same hour that you were born? And the answer to that hypothetical question is not very likely, in case you're slow-witted. But yeah, I do think it seems incredibly plausible that some sort of non-living thing that was left behind or invented by this culture could be found or could find us or just crash land somewhere, or could have crash landed many years ago and we'll dig it up one day. It'll be under the Arctic ice sheet, just this, alien spacecraft with no life aboard, but a, really smart robot that tells us the story of this entire civilization that lived and died millions of years ago. All right, footnotes. We started out with Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots by the Flaming Lips off of their album by the same title. Just an awesome album from 2002 that I've always assumed was about a battle with extraterrestrial robotic life forms, but now I'm realizing they don't say that anywhere on the album. They really just dropped the concept of the concept album pretty soon after that song ends. But first song on the album, Fight Test, is amazing. Do You Realize is amazing. Just a good, solid album. There's some songs that aren't great, but Fight Test is amazing. Yoshimi Battles of Pink Robots is great. And a couple other good ones for anyone who ever claims that drugs never did anything constructive for humankind. This album is Exhibit A, so that's not true. And we are closing out with ATLians off the album by the same name by Outkast. Two title tracks off albums from when I was a teenager for no reason. We're listening to this one because of obvious reasons of thematic similarity, but also I'm just constantly tormented by the fear that people only know Outkast as that rap group who did Miss Jackson and Hey Ya. This album, ATLians, reference to them being from the ATL, Atlanta, and the fact that they believe they're aliens, I guess? But it's probably held up the best for me of any of their albums. Definitely of their earlier stuff. It was only their second album. Their first one was about being pimps and smoking weed, and, lyrically, it was great, but sort of conventional, what you expect rap albums from that period of the 90s to be about. And then they released this second one where they claim to be aliens, and the first three songs, two dope boys, the one you heard at the end there and that we'll ride out to, ATLians, and then Wheels of Steel, are just the awesomest way possible to come out of the closet as a couple of weirdos, I guess. Go download this album if you like rap music and haven't heard it. Babylon, Whalen, Millennium, also amazing songs off of ATLians. All right, that was our podcast. Back next week with something else that is not this. Thanks for listening. You heard the ATLians, so back the hell up off. Softly, as if I play piano in the dark. Found a way to channel my anger, not to involve. The world's a stage and everybody got to play their part. God works in mysterious ways, so when he starts the job of speaking through us, we be so sincere with this here. No drugs or alcohol, so I can get the signal clear as day. Put my Glock away, I got a stronger weapon that never runs out of ammunition, so I'm ready for war, okay? Throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care. And if they like fish and grits and all that pimp shit, everybody let me hear you say, oh yeah, yeah. Now throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care. And if they like fish and grits and all that pimp shit, everybody let me hear you say, oh yeah, yeah. This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com. Earwolf Radio. Boom.com.
The wolf's dead.